Okay, so good. I'm happy that you're happy to be here and that you made it here and that I made it here, which was not a guarantee. And today I wanted to build a little bit on last week's sutta, which was about samatha and vipassana, when to practice calm or serenity, when to practice insight or wisdom practices, or let's say practices that are likely to lead to wisdom or that are geared towards wisdom and insight arising. And of course, it's not really as much to do with technique as it is to do with our own readiness, our own awareness, our own inclination in a sense. But really, it's an impersonal process that happens despite us, and you can gain great wisdom, great insight through samadhi practice. You can also gain a lot of stillness through insight practice. So the two can't really be separated out. And yet there are different kind of nuances in each practice and different things that we can include. And so today I just opened, because I thought we had all the suttas at my parents' house. This is my parents' house. But I actually don't. I only have the Majjhima Nikaya and In the Buddha's Words. And this is another anthology by the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is very handy because we can open it wherever we wish. And I opened it at Shining the Light of Wisdom. I don't know which chapter that is, but the sutta that came out, jumped out to me, was from the Anguttara 8s, number 2, AN8-2. And in this anthology, he calls this particular excerpt the conditions for wisdom. So, do we want to be wise? Do we want to know something that's going to help us in our life? How do we do that? Is it more effort? What are the conditions that give rise to wisdom? Just today, I was out with my best friend from childhood. We've known each other since we were 4 years old. That's 46 years of very close friendship. And her little boy is now 8. And I told him that I was giving a class today, and he said, "What's it about?" I said, "Oh, it's going to be on wisdom." And he said, "Well, what is wisdom?" So then I was put on the spot by an 8-year-old to answer, "What is wisdom?" in a single sentence, or in a very brief way. And so I said, "Wisdom is knowing how to live happily, causing the least harm possible." Is that a good definition? That's not a bad start, right? I actually said without harming anyone, and then I realized it was not really possible not to harm anyone at all. By virtue of being human, we're going to tread on an insect, we're going to say the wrong thing, we're going to cause some hurt or harm, even with the very best of intentions. But to minimize that harm and to perceive, to learn to see things in a way that brings about genuine happiness for ourselves. Before we go further, I just want to apologize. I don't have my usual microphone, which I think gives much better sound. So, because it's kind of going through the computer, it sometimes goes in and out a little bit. So, you might be noticing that already. I'll try and raise my voice. But if that happens, please just try to follow along because it does come back. So, it may be in and out, but it will keep reconnecting. So, I hope that it won't diminish your experience too much. Okay, so here we go. This is what the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates. And do you have the sort of central version as well that I can hold? Yeah,
That's the
awesome.
part. That's the dot-dot-dot part that you can never just
Oh,
read.
okay, yeah. Wow, that's so dark I can barely see the screen. Can you make it brighter? Yeah. All right, I will begin. And this is a slightly older translation, I think, because it sounds a little bit archaic. For example, it says, "O monks," and usually it says bhikkhus or something like this. Yeah, this is quite different, actually. Okay. Maybe I should go from this one. Is this also Bhikkhu Bodhi? All right, I'm not going to do the book anymore. Here we go. I'm going on the phone. So, bhikkhus or monastics or community. So let's be as inclusive as we possibly can. There are these eight causes and conditions that lead to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained. and to its increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. What eight? So first of all, these lead to the obtaining of wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, in other words, fundamental to enlightenment. When it has not been obtained, we can always add the word yet, and to its increase after it has been obtained. So even when we are wise, and I'm presuming that this means to the level of stream winning, we can still continue to apply the same causes and conditions in order to bring about its increased maturation and fulfillment. So the path remains the same. It's not that the path before stream winning is different from the path for a stream winner. You know, some people say, what do I do next? Or what do I do after such and such? We carry on. We carry on along the same principles of the Dhamma and just bring that to fulfillment, bring it to increase. So the path doesn't change. Okay, so here we go. What eight? Number one, here a person, and this does mean a monastic, but I think we can probably relate this to ourselves as well, to yourselves as well, who are not monastics. Here a person lives in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk or nun in the position of a teacher, towards whom they have set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, affection and reverence. This is the first cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it's not been obtained, and to its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. So here clearly we're talking about our companions, and particularly our spiritual companions, which is why in a monastic setting it's fundamental to live in dependence upon a teacher or someone who we can look up to as exemplifying or at least demonstrating qualities we can admire and we can live up to, we want to live up to, and that can encourage us in that way. So a certain fellow monastic in the position of a teacher, it says here. And then it says, towards whom one has set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, which are not very satisfactory translations to me. They're the translations for Hiri Otapa, which are considered the guardian of our ethical conducts, the guardians of it. So I think of these more as, instead of shame, something like moral conscience, that sense of conscience that tells us when we've done something that wasn't worthy of us or worthy of another person. And moral dread, again, instead of dreading something, I think caution is a much nicer word. Moral caution, being cautious, being scrupulous, if you like, or having a sense of, what's the word, consideration for others. Consideration about our behaviours. This thing keeps coming down. Phones. It'll keep doing it, will it? No. Okay. Yeah. So moral shame and moral dread. Let's say moral conscience and moral caution, affection and reverence. I think this is very beautiful that the two go together. Because sometimes people think that affection doesn't really have a place. We should all be kind of very aloof and detached from each other. But in my experience, there's a lot of affection towards a teacher. A sense of real... English words don't really do it justice. I think reverence is something that comes close for me. But it's a kind of loving reverence. It's not devoid of emotion or warmth or tender care. It's not distant. You know, it's something very nurturing, very beautiful, and it goes both ways. When we say living independence, a lay or monastic disciple, usually monastic disciple, lives independence on the teacher, and in the ordination, the aspirant actually says they take dependence on the teacher, and that now The teacher is their burden and you are the teacher's burden. I actually really like that because it's a voluntary burden that you take upon yourself, but it goes both ways. So the disciple is a burden in the sense that we now have responsibility to provide their requisites and their sense of their training, right? We're in a sense responsible for nurturing their path as best we can and providing those conditions that will give rise to wisdom. And the disciple also has a sense of a duty to take care of the teacher in whatever ways they can. Seminary Upachala takes care of me in so many ways. She provides my hot water in abundance whenever I need it. There it is. And she brought along my medicines just now and another translation of this sutta. And it's that sort of attention to detail, caring for one another, that builds a very beautiful relationship where learning the Dhamma can happen. It's a conducive condition in which we can learn the Dhamma together. So it's not only learning intellectually, but learning through our acts as well. And I think this doesn't only relate to monastic life. Of course, we can live in, you know, good partnerships. We can live in intentional community as lay people as well. And we can try to embody and bring in some of these principles. So that is the first one. And I just wanted to talk about those terms so that it doesn't sound too alienating, really, using words like shame and dread. So I'll go through them and we'll have some discussion afterwards. But if you do have questions along the way or anything needs clarity, etc., please do say, either in the chat or by raising your hands at any time. If I'm not in a position to come to you at that moment, I'll do so as soon as I can. So someone actually has put a question in the chat. Are our managers also our teachers? Who should we bring hot water and medicine to? Oh, I think we should bring hot water and medicine to everybody if we can, anyone we can. If we can help somebody physically in any small way, then it doesn't matter if they're our teacher or not. But whether our managers are our teachers or not, I think in the context here, we're talking about spiritual teachers. They may be our boss and they may know more in a certain field. And so, yes, we should do well to kind of, you know, listen to their advice or try to fulfill our role, fulfill our duty towards them and towards the work they give us, you know, fulfill our responsibilities. But I don't think they're necessarily our teachers in terms of their conduct. For that, you have to use your own discernment to find out. But I'm sure that if you do bring your boss hot water, maybe hot water with coffee in it or whatever they like, try and find out what they actually like and what supports them. I'm sure it can cultivate a really good relationship over time. There's this lovely story that Ajahn Brahm tells about, I don't think it was him. It was a group of prisoners that he used to go to see. And they had a really tyrannical prison guard, really tyrannical. He was a bully. He was picking on the prisoners, trying to make their life an absolute misery. And one of them said to Ajahn Brahm or to whichever monk was visiting at that time, this person is beyond hope. He's not even a human being. This person is a tyrant. He's so terrible. And the advice that the monastics gave was to really try to treat him with kindness and to bring him biscuits, to bring him tea and coffee, to try and find out what he needed. And so this particular prisoner took it to heart and decided to do this every single day. And he was basically completely ignored. He was just treated again like, you know, as though he wasn't a real human being worthy of even a glance. And this continued for months and months and months until one day the monk, I don't know if it was Ajahn Brahm, went back to the prison and met this prisoner again, the person who was in prison again, and they came running up to him. There was a breakthrough. There was a breakthrough at last. This morning when I offered the tea and a biscuit, the prison guard went, That was the breakthrough. He actually grunted and acknowledged the gift. And that gave him so much encouragement that he continued to do this each day until the prison guard realized, hey, this person's serious. And eventually they started saying thank you and changing their behavior. But it took about a year, at least about a year. So I don't know if you've got that much patience with your manager or even if it's necessary, but kindness is always a good thing. Diana. I wonder if Matthias could unmute today because I'm holding a couple of things in my hand.
I just got it.
Super.
Thank you. Hi, Venerable Chanda.
Hi.
I wanted to say something about shame.
Yeah.
Because shaming is something that we don't want to do to other people. And so I think shame has gotten a bad rap in a sense, because there's a couple of things that I've done in my past that I do feel ashamed of.
Yeah.
And I'm okay carrying that because I feel like it's a clear signal of right and wrong. And I made a big mistake. And I know why I made that mistake. And I can, on a certain level, forgive myself at the same time as I feel ashamed that I did it. And without being eaten up by the shame so that it prevents me from doing good in my life, I don't think it's wrong to feel shame. I mean, maybe there's a healthy kind of shame we can feel because it propels us to do better.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I wonder what you think about that.
I wonder if it's a matter of how we understand the word shame. I think, generally speaking, shame is a little bit painful, or very painful, because we tend to take it as something about ourselves. And in that sense, I think it can build self-view. That's something actually wrong with us as a person. I've heard that that's the difference with guilt. Guilt tends to be about something we've done. Shame tends to be about who we think we are, whether we think we're worthy. But it might not mean that to you. I think a healthy sense of regret and remorse is helpful. For me, that's probably easier to relate to than the word shame.
I mean, I guess I would say for me, a difference is it's something I don't want other people to know about me.
So it's still sort of concealed in a sense, is it? Or
yeah, like I feel that I'd be judged for that. And So I just live with it.
That's interesting. I remember on my first 30-day course with Goenkaji, this was in 1999, I think, a long time ago. I was quite young. I was the youngest on that retreat, for sure. And I had done something according to the rules of being on retreat that wasn't quite fitting in with the requirement anymore. I mean, it was a grey area, but I didn't feel good about it. I felt it should be disclosed. And I was kind of really in a state of kind of inner torture to some degree, really wrestling with my conscience, feeling like, you know, I don't feel like everything's 100% transparent, and I'm really big on transparency. It's like my biggest kind of thing in a way, like truth and honesty and openness. And I remember on day 22 in those days, 22nd discourse, the teacher said something about, if you've made a mistake, reveal it, because when you've revealed it, it's like you take the lid off it. And then all the poison, all the pus can come out of the wound. It's like taking off a scab and all the kind of toxins in there come out, and then you can kind of be free of that. And they advised us to tell the teacher. I think they've taken it out of the discourses since then, because apparently people might have related to it a bit like a confession, and it wasn't meant that way. It was meant more like as an invitation. You didn't have to do it. But I saw it as a green light, and I was like, okay, can I build up the courage? Can I build up the courage? Because, of course, I thought, oh, maybe they'll ask me to leave, or maybe they'll think I'm a terrible student or something. And as soon as I told the teacher, they just looked at me with such compassion, and they said, now you've told, the lid is taken off, you'll have a very good retreat. They just said it was such loving kindness, and I shed a couple of tears, and after that, I was so free. I felt so free. There was no judgment at all, and I realized it was me who was judging myself. So I don't know. I think if we do feel we have to keep something inside, it can be quite a pressure that we don't even perhaps realize is there. You know, there's this thing that makes us feel like smaller, or that, you know, people are seeing us, but they're not seeing the whole of us, and maybe they wouldn't really love us if they did. But maybe you'd be surprised, you know. It wasn't you who did that thing. It was the person you were then. It was the causes and conditions that you that were playing out then. You know, you didn't know what you know now. So I don't know. I think there's probably room for going deeper with self-forgiveness, but perhaps also in trusting someone that you do trust with that thing. If that ever feels right to you, it's just I'm sharing my own experience and it may not. Yeah. Shirley.
I just wanted to thank you. It's been lovely to be here after spend Christmas discussing Dhamma. I just wanted to share a simile that my first teacher explained very early on in my sort of Buddhist path about Hiriyatapa. I think it may be in the suttas or the Visuddhimagga somewhere. And it's quite a dramatic simile. It's that you've got a stick and one side, one end's red hot and the other is smeared with excrement. And you don't want to touch the red hot one because it's painful. Or you so that's the moral, that's the dread. And the shame is just that, you know, you don't want dog dirt on your shoe. It just feels a bit yucky, you know. It's just when you do something that just makes you feel a bit, you know, a bit tacky. So I just wanted to share that. It came into my mind because I always think of that when Hiriyatapa is mentioned. And it's a bit dramatic, but I find it quite helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, interesting. I'll have to consider that one, yeah, see if it's helpful for myself. I have to say, you know, I have, maybe it's not a good thing, I don't know. I have less of both. And I don't know whether that's because I feel more aligned with my own kind of ethical integrity or whether I just don't do the guilt thing anymore. I don't know. Yeah, I'll consider that. It's interesting. All right, shall we go on to the second one? So number two, the second, what was it called? Condition for wisdom. As one is living in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monastic in the position of a teacher or in lay life, towards whom one has set up a keen sense of moral caution and moral conscience and caution, let's say, affection and reverence, one approaches them from time to time and inquires, how is this, venerable? What is the meaning of this? Those venerable ones then disclose what has not been disclosed, clear up what is obscure, and dispel their perplexity about numerous perplexing points. This is the second cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, when it has not been obtained, and to its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. So here we go from actually living in dependence on this person and to the next cause and condition, which is in a sense a consequence of living in dependence or living close to someone who can help us, someone who can advise, and that is that we approach that person and ask questions. And this very much relates to last week's sutta. If you haven't heard that yet, it was it's on the YouTube channel, and it was quite in depth about the practice of samatha and vipassana, in other words the practice of the Buddhist path. But one of the things there was that if you haven't yet developed your stillness or your serenity very deeply, go to someone who has and ask them questions about it. If you haven't yet developed wisdom very deeply, go to someone who has, who's accomplished in wisdom, or at least more than you, and ask them questions about it, about how it comes about. So asking questions is very important on the Buddhist path, not only listening to Dhamma talks, not only even kind of thinking about it in your own mind, but actually asking questions. And that's why one of the highest blessings in the Mangala Sutta is Dhamma Sakaccha, the discussion of the Dhamma. One of them is listening, but then these blessings increase in power, and the next one is discussing the Dhamma. So that's what we're doing here. And just recently, I was giving a day retreat on empathy and resilience. I think the videos should be ready soon. But something really interesting was that if we don't know about a person, how they feel, if we don't know how we ourselves feel, we can still ask, we can still inquire, or we can hold a space open that's curious. And even just doing that, checking in with ourselves, what am I feeling now? You know, what might this kind of physical sensation be indicating to me? Even just asking the question opens up the neural networks for understanding to arise. Just the process of asking the question. So you don't have to have the answers. It's not like you have to know what to say to somebody who's just lost their dearest child or somebody very close to them. You can still sit with them, hold space and talk to them, ask, listen, be receptive. And just by being in that space, you're kind of, in a way, opening up your senses, your kind of emotional, ability for emotional resonance or emotional empathy, and allowing for that information to come through, how to respond or whether to respond. So asking questions is very important. And then those people will disclose whatever they can. So number three, having heard the Dhamma, so that leads on from the last, one resorts to two kinds of withdrawal. Withdrawal in body and withdrawal in mind. This is the third cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life. I think the little refrain there is fundamental to the spiritual life when it's not been obtained, and to its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. So again, even for one who has already obtained some degree of wisdom or some degree of insight or even attainment on the path, still we continue to practice. So this is the practice that's related to meditation, withdrawing the body, withdrawing the mind away from the business of the world. Sometimes that's, I would imagine this means viveka, but I'm not sure because I haven't seen the Pali, but often this is translated as seclusion or resorts to seclusion. But even if you're not, you know, fully secluded physically or fully secluded mentally from the hindrances, from the thinking mind, from the problems of the mind, still we can withdraw, we can quieten down those senses, we can start to look inside. Yeah. So stop adding all the input and just give ourselves time to process what we've heard. And to allow the Dhamma to start to kind of penetrate the mind. Yeah, we can only really do that when the mind starts to quieten. It's as though that quietness, that stillness, allows the seeds of insight to be contacted. There's a lot of latent seeds of insight in all of us, but we need to get beyond the chatter of the mind, to get beyond, in a way, what we already think we know, and actually allow those seeds to germinate and to bear their fruit. Mm-hmm. And that can be done through stillness. So number four, one is virtuous. They dwell restrained by the Patimokkha. So this is again for monastics, but otherwise restrained by the five precepts at the very least for the lay people. Is possessed of good conduct and resort. Seeing danger, here it says in minute faults, but I like seeing danger in the slightest fault. Having undertaken the training rules, although I prefer training in restraint, one trains in them. This is the fourth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, again, in one who has not yet obtained it and one who already has but wants to bring it to fulfillment. So we increase our virtue. The virtue keeps on refining and deepening. As that wisdom develops, as that understanding of the Dhamma develops, we start to see the danger in the slightest fault. I love this kind of phrase because apparently for a stream winner, this is what starts to happen. And also they say that a stream winner is someone who cannot conceal the slightest fault. Again, about that transparency, that openness, it's almost painful to conceal something because you feel as though you're not being fully, having full integrity. And of course, this, I'm talking kind of absolutes, but this is a process. It just starts to feel more painful as our sila brightens up, as our mind starts to brighten up, it starts to become almost like we just can't bear any kind of disparity in our practice and conduct. And so we'll be more likely to reveal it. We don't want to be hypocritical in any way. Kathleen, do you have your hand up? Well, I don't see the little hand, but yeah?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, thank you. What comes to mind with this one is the question for me, we're human, so we're going to be treading on other people's toes quite a lot from time to time, unintentionally. Is this also what's meant by the slightest fault?
Not necessarily, I don't think. I think the slightest fault pertains mainly to our observation of the precepts we've undertaken. So in this particular case, it's talking about the Patimokkha for monastics. And there's many slight faults you can make. There's 311 training guidelines for bhikkhunis, for example, 227 for monks. So it's easy to, you know, to transgress some of those. And some of them are, you know, less severe ethically than others. In fact, some aren't really ethical issues. They're more about the harmony and the sangha. But the more our wisdom develops, the more we'll understand the purpose even of those and how, you know, if somebody's kind of just not following along, not kind of practicing in the same way as those around them, they'll start to feel a little bit, yeah, ostracized almost. They'll feel it themselves, and the community will also feel it as a kind of incongruence, maybe. What's the word? Like a lack of cohesiveness in a way. So I think it does particularly mean our ethical conduct, and also for monastics, the training that we've undertaken, rather than the things we do unintentionally.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we can also learn to look at impact, right? This intentionality, which is one thing that we have we should take some responsibility towards, but obviously, because we can become increasingly sensitive to our motivations and intentions and try to align them with the path. But sometimes, even when our intentions are good, we might use language that isn't very skillful, for example, with people from marginalized communities, or we might not have learned about, say, nonviolent communication. There might be some work we can do to reduce the impact of our actions and of our speech.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think here it's talking about the danger of transgressing ethical conduct that would cause direct harm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. But it's a huge field. I mean, as I said from the beginning, we can't really live without causing any harm. So it's just the degree to which we can minimize that. Yeah. It also doesn't mean, I mean, sometimes it can be difficult to read these out when it pertains to the Patimokkha, because, of course, for monastics, it is a lifelong path, and the expectation of our sila is much higher and should be, right? Because we've got conditions in which there's not a lot of excuse to be made. But in the world, it's more messy, and I don't think it'd be a good idea to really scrutinize yourself to the degree where you just see so many faults, because that can be really disheartening. So remember the other advice, which is more common actually for lay people, which is to rejoice in your goodness, and for monastics as well, to really rejoice in the fact that you are all living ethical lives. Yeah. I don't know what other people think about that, if anything. Any other comments on ethics, sila, virtue? Otherwise, I shall continue. So number six, are we on number six? Oh no, we're only on number five. One has learned much, remembers what one has learned, and accumulates what one has learned. Those teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, which proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. Such teachings as these has one learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. This is the fifth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life. Again, in one who's obtained it or not yet. Okay. So teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end is sometimes translated as beneficial in the beginning, in the middle, and the end, which I think is nicer because good can mean so many things. It's like, are they good because you like them? Or, you know, are they good teachings? Are they well proclaimed? Or is it actually something helpful to us? And it does mean something that's actually helping right from the time we start to practice. So even if you're observing one precept, hopefully you're observing all five, but even observing one is going to give you benefit. Even just brushing up on, I don't know, say your consumation, did you say that? Consuming of, say, alcohol, maybe some people still drink a little bit, or, you know, I don't know. You can extend that, of course, to other things that you do that aren't very good for you. Even just cutting back on that might be really helpful, first of all. So they're good in the beginning, middle, and end. And they get better and better and better. You get more and more benefit the more you practice with the right meaning and phrasing. So the Dhamma is swakato, clearly explained. And they proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. In other words, the Buddha gives us all the teachings we could possibly need for our liberation. I was reminded recently of the little sutta that talks about the simile of leaves. Do you know that one? There's actually a very nice website called A Handful of Leaves by a Singaporean lay friend of mine. And they've got this website called A Handful of Leaves, which attempts to discuss, you know, daily things, actually, that young people tend to encounter in their life and give really nice, catchy kind of Dhamma teachings on that. And they're very progressive and well-informed. And, yeah, the simile of leaves or the handful of leaves is this story where the Buddha says, you know, how many leaves am I holding in my hand? And there aren't that many. And people say, well, how many, he says, are there more leaves in the forest or more leaves in my hand? And of course, the monastics say, well, the amount of leaves in the forest is far more than the amount of leaves in your hand. The amount of leaves in your hand is nothing compared to all the leaves in the forest. And he says, similarly, all the things that I've known, you know, all the things I do know are like the leaves in the forest. But what I teach you, what is really of benefit and of importance, are like the leaves in my hand. So he knows so much, but will distill the essence of the Dhamma and teach just the right amount, not too much, not too little. So in that sense, also, it's perfectly proclaimed. Nothing that we need to know has been left out. And, yeah. Proclaim the perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. Such teachings as these, one has learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. So we have to actually learn them. And I would say it's not just learning them intellectually, but it's taking them in, retaining them in mind, but not just cognitively, actually retaining them in ourselves so that those teachings are actually there to tap into. And that also can be brought about by generating certain qualities, right? Developing certain qualities that we can keep on going back to. Like any time that you've experienced peace, you can bring that up in your mind. You can remember it. You can go back to it again and again. Or bringing up thoughts of your goodness, your good karma, your good virtuous actions, certain qualities you've developed, you can keep on developing that, keep on building that, and return to that again as a refuge again and again. And penetrated well by view, this means to the level of stream winning. So number six. One has aroused energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. One is strong, firm in exertion, not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. This is the sixth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, either in one who has not yet obtained it or one who has but wants to bring it to fulfillment. So here we're talking about right effort or endeavor, and that comes along with energy, of course. So the energy is for abandoning the unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. So those are two aspects of right effort. So we have enough energy to actually abandon the unwholesome and acquire the wholesome. The other aspect of right effort in the Eightfold Noble Path is to abandon the unwholesome, but also to prevent them coming back, and to acquire wholesome, but also to develop them to fulfillment, which is included here. So not casting off the duty. So do we just sit there and let go? Do we just sit there and kind of blank out or dull out or rest? Or do we sometimes also pay attention to cultivating what's not yet been cultivated? Yeah, to actually realizing, yes, there is, you know, there are hindrances present in my mind, and there are also remedies for those hindrances. There's something I can do to abandon them. And sometimes it's enough just to let them be. Sometimes it's enough to have a sense of open awareness, or to direct our mind onto some other object. But at other times we can apply an antidote. So if we have ill will, we might want to, you know, actually actively pursue the practice of loving kindness. Or if we have a lot of shame or guilt or mental suffering, emotional challenge in our life, we can practice self-compassion, right? Or practice forgiveness. Maybe practice, again, cultivating a different way of looking at ourselves, thanking ourselves for the good that we see in ourselves. Yeah. So there are different things we can do to address these things. And often people ask me, is this a good idea? Is that a good idea? Should I do this when this happens? And I would say just experiment, because there's not a kind of fix all. You know, there's not one thing that you can do every time and will always work. We can kind of come at the mind from different angles, but always being very gentle, very kind of intuitive, like listening into our mind. Okay, we can have questions, comments at any time, but otherwise I'll keep reading through. So number 7. Okay, so again, it relates to our living in community, and especially for the monastic Sangha. In the midst of the Sangha, one does not engage in rambling and pointless talk. Either one themselves speaks on the Dhamma, or they request someone else to do so, or they adopt noble silence. This is the seventh cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, whether you've yet to obtain it or have already obtained it. So this is about how we come together, especially in the Sangha, especially in communities like this, where we're here to learn the Dhamma, in order to learn it as fully as we can, in order to really make the best of our time. If you were sitting there now and just kind of, you can't actually chat to each other unless you're in the same room as each other. But if you were having, you know, another conversation in the background and it was about something completely, you know, completely different, you would probably miss something, right? It wouldn't probably disturb the group, so don't worry, because we're all muted. But still, it would distract your mind. And so a very respectful way, a way that gives sort of gravitas, if you like, to what's being said, is to abstain from engaging in rambling, pointless talk. Maybe some of you can relate to this, like many of us probably do seek out opportunities to talk about the Dhamma, and that's why you're here. And sometimes when we're with our family or people that are not on the same path, it can seem kind of rather rambling and pointless. Sometimes I find myself getting quite judgy about that. And I've had to remind myself in the past that it doesn't really always matter what's being said. Like, say if it's your parents or something like this, you know, and you love them and you know they have goodwill towards you and you want to express goodwill back. Sometimes the words are just a way to connect and the content's not important. We don't actually have to engage with all the kind of things that aren't really worth commenting on, but we can see it as a way to just exchange energy, if you like, exchange kindness and a sense of being together. You know, like people will be like, oh, my nail's broken or something like this. And it's like, oh, that's a shame. Have you had your calcium pills? Yeah. I should be careful with my examples. But it's fine. It's a way of showing love. We might not have the same kind of things that we value, but still we can meet people where they're at, right? But at least when we come together in the Sangha, it's the time to speak on the Dhamma. And I think this is so beautiful. Either oneself speaks on it, or they request someone else to, or you adopt noble silence. Ajahn Brahm likes to say, if you can't improve on the silence, don't speak. So shall we stop? Or is this improving? I think, you know, when we talk about the Dhamma, there is a chance for wisdom to arise. You know, we're putting some new input into the conditioned program that our mind is. And there's a chance for something new, some wisdom to arise, some different way of looking at something we're working with, or maybe something we didn't know we need to look at, right? So this is also a cause that leads to obtaining wisdom. It's interesting here that so much of it seems like just exposing ourselves to the Dhamma and allowing the Dhamma to work on us. And lastly, this is a little bit more investigative in our practice. And this could pertain to the practice of so-called insight meditation, if you like. One dwells contemplating arising and vanishing in the five aggregates subject to clinging, or the five components of existence. So we dwell contemplating them in this way. Such is form, such its origin, such its passing away. So that's the component of existence, that is the rupa kanda, that means the material aggregate or the material component of existence. In other words, the body. Stuff, but physical stuff that we can actually directly experience. Such is form, in other words, physical matter. Such is its origin, what leads to its arising, and such is its passing away. And the same for the other five. Such is feeling, that's Vedana. Ajahn Brahm likes to translate that as experience, the aspect of pleasure, pain, and somewhere in between, neither pleasant nor painful, neutral experience. Such is origin and such is passing away. The third one, such is perception, sanya. Such is origin, such is passing away. Such are volitional formations, that's volitional action. Oh, actually it says here volitional activities, yeah. Volitional action. I mean, I kind of like, Ajahn Brahm often says will, because Ajahn Brahmani's kind of convinced him that that's the main aspect of this. And I think he's always said it's a big part. It's the kind of doing part of the mind, the karma formation, if you like. But it also means, I mean, in this context, it probably does mean the actual action itself, our kind of will, our doing, our kind of doer part of the mind. But it can also mean anything that's fabricated at all. So such is that, such its origin, and such its passing away. And lastly, the last of these five components of existence, such is consciousness. And to be true to my teacher, he would always translate that as consciousnesses, because there are actually six kinds of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. So such is consciousnesses, or are consciousnesses, such their origin, such their passing away. This is the eighth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it's not been obtained, and to its increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. So there we go. Quite a deep sutta, a sequential sutta in some way, but not in every way, because some of these don't necessarily follow on. But if these are all in place, then we have the maximum possibility of learning to see deeply and of wisdom arising. So this doesn't highlight Samatha practice as such, but it does give the foundations, and it does talk about meditation, It does talk about withdrawing the body, withdrawing the mind. So in a sense, that means from the five hindrances, from the five senses, and then exposing ourselves to the teachings from people we really trust. So someone said, even just number 8 would be enough to occupy a lifetime, and it would occupy many lifetimes if it was only number 8. Because it does require the foundation of the others. And if not, you know, in a Sangha as a monastic, at least by exposing ourselves to the Dhamma, and especially to having that development of sila, that development of ethical conduct, virtue, goodness, etc. And also remember, when it talks about living independence on a person who inspires that faith, doesn't really say the word faith, but someone who we think is worthy, basically, then that also includes association with the wise. Okay? Association with the wise is the first blessing in the Mangala Sutta. Sevana chabalanam panditanam cha sevana. Not to associate with fools, but to associate with the wise, with pandits, pandita. You might know the word pandit is still means a kind of learned or holy person in India, a pandit. So there is the sutta, and we still have time for some discussion on this. So please do engage. Do you know how to practice this? Any questions on the actual practice or on any aspect of this? How to find a teacher, how to develop our virtue, etc., etc. So this is your time to, ask questions, and please make it personal. It doesn't have to be directly related to a particular point in the sutta, but anything at all that you'd like a bit of guidance or help with. And if you do want to speak, that's even better, but I see there's a question in the chat. Do you want me to read it, or do you want to speak? Don't mind. Do you want to speak? Yeah. We invite you. Could read it out if you want.
Hi, can you hear me, Benchanda?
Sorry? Yes.
Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Okay, fine. Yeah, I'm a little bit shy because my English is not so good. So what came to my mind was there were the Christmas season, and with the family there was no much time to get in touch with the Dhamma.
Yeah.
And to, before I had a lot of time to engage with the Dhamma. And so then it seems the way or the path seems more easy to go. And because there were no hindrances really coming up. In the practice. Yeah. And now my question is, when there's not so much time and you are distracted more and more stressed, and what you say that other people are not so in the Dhamma and they are talking about things, and you see this for your own, and you see judgment in yourself about this because you are on an other, completely other film inside. And I don't know. Then afterwards, what I wrote in the chat afterwards, I reflected on this and I thought, when there's no problem, okay, then maybe I would think it's okay, it's going well, but then one little stone on the path and I'm fall over and everything's going not so well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you can feel that everything's not going well, but I think it is just a small little stone. It's, you know, you're not actually tripped up over it. It was too small to trip up on. You just saw that there were still a few little stones there to move. But I mean, they always say, you know, if you think you're enlightened, go back and see your family. So it can be the case in practice, can't it, where we think we don't really see too many hindrances. I mean, I see plenty these days, I must admit, you know, but it's due to the role and the challenges that I undertake and the lack of sleep and all this stuff. So I know that that doesn't mean I'm going back. I know it just means I've actually got more confidence that I can do more difficult things and still not actually, you know, fail in my ethical conduct. And I can still practice and I can still have a rains retreat where I deepen my practice. But there are times that it might not feel that that's all the time, right? And I think it's just a matter of developing trust that you are doing your best and that nothing goes to waste. And we still have our triggers. We still have our areas where we can learn to be much more patient with others, you know, and not identify so strongly with this meditative version of ourselves, you know. Because I think that judgment can, it's often a judgment that looks down, right? It's not usually a judgment of, oh, they're so much better and wiser than me. It's usually like, I'm wiser because I'm practicing the Dhamma and they just talk about blah, blah, and I talk about the Dhamma. So, you know, we can see that in ourselves, right? And I mean, there's something about that that's not a bad thing because it shows us that what we value does make sense to us, but also to develop that humility alongside it is so important. I mean, one of the things that I try to do is realize that when I don't have as much time to practice, just trust that it's going to give me more incentive later when the opportunities arise. So just tread water, if you like, you know, tread water, forgive yourself, notice your triggers, forgive yourself again, be a little bit more kind, I didn't manage, never mind, forgive yourself, try again. And then it's like, oh, it is painful not to be able to practice, not to be able to live up to my own standards. So when I get the opportunity, let me really make use. And you'll probably find that for all of us, or many of us, if we are with family and it's difficult, that when we have a little bit more space again, we probably will really reappreciate the peace.
Oh, yes.
So that's something to celebrate, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And if you've made it without too many absolute breakdowns, then you're doing pretty well. You know, I mean, there's been times where it's just been, it's really knocked me, you know, for several weeks. So I consider that this time it's going pretty well, nothing too terrible. And yeah, you know, there's always going to be a lot of emotional challenge in a way. Even if you get on really well with your family, if you're like me and you've got aging parents, I mean, there's some sadness there, you know, there's some concern, I can see they suffer, I can see there's sometimes a lack of acceptance of the aging process, a lot of fear, and that does affect us, of course it does. So you're a human being, yeah, you're going to be triggered, if not there then nowhere, I would say. I don't know if that helps. There's more of a question there too. Is it simply okay to reflect on it afterwards and forgive? Yeah, that's all you can do. So yes. Does it require more patience? Yes, but patience develops gradually. Perhaps patience with being impatient. We can't just have patience when we want it on demand. Perhaps able to let go more and recognize or accept the time rather at the beginning. Don't even judge it. You don't know where you are. We're somewhere, but we're not, you know, we're not near the end probably, but we're not right at the beginning either. So you can't really know. That's what I've learned. You can't really know. People that do have breakthroughs, have insights, they usually say they had no idea it was coming. So you just don't know. All you can do is try to develop the path. Yeah. So someone else said, interactions with the family and people in the environment just make me aware of the fear in my mind. Brilliant. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. We have to see what's there. It'd be really terrible, wouldn't it, if we thought we were kind of much further on the path and then we realised we weren't, like, and we were about to die or something. At least we realise it now. Hopefully no one's about to die, but we don't know. So it's always good to know what's there. Start again next moment is a new opportunity to practice correctly. Start again next moment is a new opportunity. Exactly, it's about just letting go of the last one, not judging again. So easy to judge. If we judge others, it's probably because we still judge ourselves. You know, what was it I was saying to you recently about, you know, sort of wanting to empathize with someone else's perspective, even if someone's not treating me well, I sort of try and think, well, how is it for them? You know, I can understand that that might be the case. They probably didn't get the love they needed either. That's why they can't give it to me, or whatever it might be. But that shouldn't mean that I don't acknowledge my own needs, right? Maybe I do need also more respect or more love. And yes, that person might not be able to give it, but the two can coexist. Yeah. I don't know how that relates to that question, but I guess it's this idea of, you know, just being true in each moment with what's needed and sometimes giving ourselves what we need. Yeah. It's nice to see Helen's family there. Hi. How's Christmas been for you? Do you celebrate Christmas even? Do you?
Yeah, a bit.
Yeah? Did you have a nice cake or something?
Yeah.
Excellent. That's great. And what was the nicest thing about Christmas for you? What do you enjoy?
We went to visit our neighbour.
Oh, lovely.
And we helped to look after a dog. Because our friend is away for 3 months.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And Victoria is taking dogs out every day.
Oh, really? Well done. Yeah. That's a lovely act of kindness, isn't it? Are they your neighbour's dogs or your own?
No, one of our friend.
One of your friends. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Great. It's always nice to have a fluffy animal in the mix. I think if we all had a few more fluffy animals, we might find it easier. Yeah, great. Well, thank you for saying hi, and hope you have a lovely time with your family over New Year as well. Yeah. Okay, another question or comment. I wonder which role actions or being active in a good way for others. Being active in a good way for others do play in being wise. Oh, okay. I wonder which role actions or being active in a good way for others. Yeah. What role do they play in being wise? Being active in a good way for others. A big role, I would say. Yeah. Because I think that when we do have, you know, good intentions of kindness, of non-harm, of generosity, etc., it's good to have the intention, but if it's really a genuine intention, it will spill over in our speech and in our actions. We'll want to find some way to express that. It's almost like the heart starts to burst. Do you ever feel that? It's like your heart just feels like it. It's really hard for me when I see things say about, you know, the genocides going on in Gaza and the mess in Sudan, the famine and all the problems in Myanmar are very close to my heart. And as a monastic, I can't do very much like at the material level because I can't make a donation, right? I don't have funds. And then your heart just wants to burst and you see these children that are literally dying, right, from not having enough food. And I just think, gosh, if only I could kind of invite them for lunch or send them food, but I can do something, you know, and I could put up a little fundraiser on my Facebook page or something like this. So I think this being active in a good way plays a big role. One of the things about wisdom is we need to see that suffering is cause. There is a cause, but we also need to see that suffering is universal and the cause is universal too, right? To extend our understanding of, say, the Four Noble Truths of suffering, what causes it, you could also relate that to the khandhas, right? So the arising and passing away of this physical body, the arising and passing away of the mental states. It's not just for us that this is happening, it's for everyone. And I think extending it to that sense of universality is so important in developing wisdom. Yeah. One of the quotes that I really like from the Gaza Poets Society, actually, that I used in the Empathy and Resilience Day Retreat was written by one of the poets. Selective empathy produces selective humanity. So getting this sense that we're all in this together. I can't really say the same boat. Some of us don't even have a boat, quite literally. It's different. The suffering's different. But to know that nobody's exempt, nobody, not even those who inflict great harm on others, even if they don't understand what they're doing, they seem to be kind of immune to any consequence of their actions. Believe me, they're not happy, and they're creating a lot of misery going on. So I think being active in this way is extremely important. It's also a sign of wisdom starting to manifest, because we're thinking about others beyond ourselves. We're starting to dissolve this sort of self-importance, being the sort of central player in our life. So yeah, it's very important. Of course, it's a way to achieve, which one was it? Was it the fifth one or the sixth one? The sixth one in the sutta that I read about living with energy set upon the abandoning of unwholesome states and acquiring the wholesome. So part of acquiring the wholesome states is to actually, you know, have virtuous behavior, do good in the world. Yeah, very important part of the path. Basically, for wisdom to arise, we need the whole Eightfold Path, as usual. So going back to that Eightfold Path again and again and again, and you can usually fit any of the Dhamma teachings into one or the other of those eight factors. Some of them, you know, cross many factors, but I think it's a really nice framework just to kind of add the knowledge that you gain through these discussions or through your own reading of the text to those aspects of the path and just, you know, acknowledge it. Yeah, I've put a few drops in this particular aspect of the path today, you know, I've increased it, I've improved my right effort, or I've improved my understanding, or I've improved, you know, I've had a few moments of peace. That's my samadhi getting stronger. So see if you can align what you do with the Eightfold Path. Okay, I thought it was a shortish sutta. I thought I wouldn't have a lot of energy to talk very much, but hopefully we have fleshed it out in a way that's helpful and can be inspiring. I really don't like leaving out any question. If you have another minute, I will just go to the last little bit, which is, can it be weight against each other, meditating versus being active in a good way? Not really, because unless you're on retreat all the time, you know, you're going to be active in a good way. The main thing is you resource yourself enough to do good in the world. But I don't think we have a lot of choice. I mean, I'm always asking, you know, and I think especially in my earlier years in the practice, oh, what's the right balance? How much service? How much sitting? How much this? How much that? Later on, it's like I've abandoned myself to all that. It's like I just respond to whatever's asked. And I do make sure I have some retreat time every year. I'm a Buddhist nun. You know, I want to get enlightened. I want to meditate. But at the same time, I've renounced. And part of that renunciation is surrendering to what is asked, to what's right in front of me. Yeah. But try to make sure you stay resourced. And if you do find you're getting on the path towards burnout, pull back a little bit. Yeah. But if you're actually doing good in an active way, you'll find that most of the time that's resourcing to a point, if it's really doing good. Yeah. It should uplift your mind. Reflect on it afterwards. It's important. And then that brings up the joy connected with those acts. Yeah. Okay, so wishing you an ongoing patient and peaceful, if possible, and gentle time with your families. Try to make it loving, and you don't know when you next be together. I know not all of us, you're probably with family, but whoever you're around, and if that's yourself, then you are your family right now. So please take care. So Manuri is not here to give a Dharma talk, but there is some information in the chat. We do not have a metta meditation tomorrow. We do have a 2-day retreat on loving kindness for Sheffield Insight on the 2nd and 3rd of January. If you can make it to Sheffield, great. I think if you've not booked in, you're not going to get in, but you can join online for 1 day or for 2 days. So if you can go online, you can find it on our events page, or you can go to the Sheffield Insight website, and it's on the 2nd or 3rd of Jan. So you can join for just the 2nd, just the 3rd, or for both. And I'm quite happy, even if they say they want you to attend full time, I'm quite happy if you want to pop in and out. That's fine. I think there's plenty of capacity on Zoom. So, yeah, I'll see some of you then. And I guess after that, it's pretty much back to the usual schedule. So just look on our webpage to find out exactly when we'll be teaching. All right. So take care, everybody. And we can wave goodbye. Ciao. You can unmute yourselves if you wish.